Wherefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. As a young Christian, just starting my second year of college out in California, I marked verses in my Bible that stood out to me, and I started reading in the Gospel of John, and which ended up being just one mass of underlined verses. They all stood out to me. And then it was along about that time that I came across the idea of a life verse. And I remember very distinctly feeling that 1 Corinthians 15:58 should be my life verse. And that was not only underlined, but a circle drawn around it. Since that time, I have changed life verses quite often for various reasons. Others have seemed outstanding to me at the particular time. But none better or more challenging, I don't believe, than 1 Corinthians 15:58. I have needed that verse through the 27 years I've been with the Navigators, almost 27. I remember 2 years ago, when I was out in Hong Kong, I went out across to the Hong Kong side and hunted up the grave of one of our staff members, Dean Dendler, who died at 32 years of age after a very fruitful ministry. And there all by myself, I read 1 Corinthians 15 about the resurrection. And then it ends up with this tremendous challenge. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. And I hadn't really anticipated that punchline, that challenge, on the end of that 1 Corinthians 15 chapter as I was standing there by myself reading that portion. And so I just dropped down on my knees there all by myself and just rededicated myself once more to the work of the Lord. I don't know how it is with you, but I have a pretty good hunch. I've known some of you for quite a few years. And I'm sure that you, as I, need to periodically rededicate yourself to the Lord and to His work. I do. I find that I'm very much like a TV set that gets jostled and bumped and knocked around, and the picture gets out of focus, gets blurred. And then I need to get off and alone and away with God, and particularly, not totally alone, but in the company of stimulating fellowship, where I can be with some stimulating Christians for a bit, then off alone a little bit, and then with them, and then off alone a little bit. That kind of a thing, to get the picture back into focus. Life and its difficulties and its concerns and one thing and another just means you have to take time to get it into focus once again. And so that day, this came into focus in my life. And I sure needed it the rest of that trip, I can tell you. I got on down to Australia and New Zealand, and by that time I was so tired I didn't think I could make one more meeting. I said to Roy Robertson and to Joe Simmons, I said, I don't think I can make it. It was the last one on the trip. And then 1 Corinthians 15:58 came to my mind, and I did it. And it was of no strength of my own, but as far as I can tell, with the greatest open evidence of the entire trip of the Lord's blessing on a single message. But that took me through. I guess that was about 2.5 years ago, and about 6 or 8 months later, I was in the airport in London, and I had been in London for about a month helping train counselors for the Billy Graham Crusade, and I was a little bit wrung out once again, and not particularly bouncy, either spiritually or physically. And I thought about this incident the other day when the Scotland Yard had picked up this James Earl Ray in the London airport. because on that day a Scotland Yard detective whom my acquaintance I had met saw me. And he accompanied me out to the plane. And on the way out, he said to me, he said, "I hope you'll forgive me, but I would assume that maybe after a long time like you've been over here, that maybe you could use a little encouragement." He said, "As I saw you and I just was praying about it, I thought the Lord wanted me to give you 1 Corinthians 15:58. And so as I went through the gate to get out on a TWA plane headed for Denver, this Scotland Yard detective quoted to me, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord." Well, I began to get the idea that it might be that the Lord wanted me to get 1 Corinthians 15:58. And I'd say that tonight I could use it again. And perhaps you can too. So I'd like us to think just for a few moments about it. What is the work of the Lord? Now, there are a lot of things we could talk about as to what it is probably not. And there are things that are good things that Christians engage in, but I'm not certain if they are the central thing when we speak of the work of the Lord. Is it to put up buildings? Well, that's not wrong, but is that the work of the Lord? The essential, central work of the Lord? Is it increased attendance in whatever thing we're trying to promote or to do? Is it to alleviate poverty? Is it to participate in demonstrations? Is it personal evangelism? What is it? Well, in the New Testament, there are various ways to describe the work of the Lord. And just recently, there came to me an old truth in a new way describing the work of the Lord. And that is found in 2 Corinthians 5:19. "All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation." The ministry of reconciliation. The ministry of reconciliation. I don't know how much you keep up on what's going on in the theological circles and so on, and I would say don't spend too much time at it, because by the time you catch on to what's going on, that's out of date and there's something new anyway. And leave that to those whose business is that. But there's been a lot of talk in the last few years that some of the Bible language is out of date. In fact, some reverends have been suggesting that the Bible needs to be rewritten and brought up to date. And that some of these long 12-cylinder words just don't speak to people anymore. But I began to think about this 12-cylinder word called reconciliation. I don't believe that I could think of a word that is more up to date in 1968 than that word, which means to bring into harmony, to bring into peace, to renew peace and unity, but especially to bring into harmony. For instance, just take the world in which we live today. Nation against nation. Perhaps you saw Billy Graham on television last week, and the first night he pointed out that since the United Nations was formed to help keep us out of wars in the world, since the day it was formed, we have had 44 wars. Nations against nation, everywhere you go. I've been traveling for 17 years, and on this last trip to Europe, Middle East, and Africa, I saw more animosity toward America and Americans than any time in my 17 years of travel. But not only there, but between other nations. Race against race. It is a shattering thing when you think about all that has been done. To have a report come out that we're worse off and that the races are polarizing separately and unequal and with deepening antipathies between them. And it's not just black and white. It's the Arabs and the Israelis. I tell you, you talk about heat and feeling. You just get around some of the Arab countries, and I mean to say there is heat and feeling. Isn't that right, Levon? You've been out there. You don't talk about Israel, it's occupied Palestine. I mean, it's electric in the air. You go down into Africa and you find that the Indians are the shopkeepers and all being driven out by the Africans. But race against race, nation against nation, reconciliation is needed, isn't it? Or students against administrations. Last fall, I did a little traveling to visit some student bodies. And the fellows thought back at Indiana University, which I consider to be, a conservative Midwestern university of about 30,000 students. They thought I might like to have an interview with the student body president. So they arranged this. They said he was a leftist, and they thought I might like to talk with him. So we went over to the student office and got on the elevator to go up to the student government offices. And a fellow got on with his pointed shoes, his tight blue denim pants, his checkered cotton shirt open at the neck, a big kind of a Mackinac-type jacket with a big black armband with the Star of David on it and the word peace, with the beard and the hair to go with it, carrying a guitar. And our local representative nudged me and said, "That's our man." And he held up the elevator I found out later, to wait for the person that proved to be his wife. She had her hair parted in the middle, brought back on the side, and she looked a lot like, I'd imagine, Pocahontas would have looked. She got on and went up to the room, and I want to tell you, we had an hour with a young man that I consider to be a vicious young man. Oh, I'm sure he tried to use the shock treatment on me. But for instance, one statement is, he said, I've considered a tragedy that any girl is still a virgin at 15 years of age. And part of what he and his buddies are trying to do is to throw off what little restraints and rules that there are today. Not only that, I'm convinced that they are part of a national hookup. And I could explain why I believe so. Reconciliation today, the hatreds, the antipathies. Take the matter of children against parents and the parents that have given up. I'm convinced that today one reason that we're fighting in the streets is because we have lost the battle in the home. And I am more convinced than ever of the necessity of a ministry of reconciliation that Christians need to perform in homes, children and parents, and not only children and parents, but husbands and wives. Think of all the arguing, the fighting, and all the tensions and the words that go on in a home where in America today, one out of three or four marriages ends in divorce. And we see this in our navigator work. The young men and women that we work with in college or in the service, they don't even know what it is to have harmony in just any kind in a home, to say nothing about the love of a Christian home. And person to person, person against person, just like everywhere you go, you see it, don't you? We were out to Knott's Berry Farm, and I was out there for the Wycliffe board meetings, and asked the girl how she was, and she said terrible. And we got her story of her struggle. Last night I go down to get some gas at the Texaco station, and I ask the fellow how things are going, and he's running around there, pretty busy, and I took a little sympathetic understanding, and he began to tell me he's out at Fort Carson, he's moonlighting in the Texaco station, and we know what's bothering him. This top sergeant is about to drive him out of his mind. And he went on to tell me, he said, "I just came back from Vietnam, and I want you to know that it was far easier to be out there under fire than to work for this top sergeant." And he said, if I can stand it 51 more days, it'll be about all I can do. Conflict everywhere you go. Disharmony, disorientation. I say that reconciliation is an up-to-date word as I can think of. And Paul said that we've been given the ministry of reconciliation. And I'd say there is a terrific way to describe the work of the Lord. Don't you think so? And we know what the cause is, don't we? The cause is a three-letter word called sin that has alienated us from God, has put us in conflict with others, and has enslaved us to ourselves. And we need reconciliation. We need harmony with God restored, harmony with our fellows, and harmony down inside. Now there's the work of the Lord, isn't it? Now when it talks about a ministry of reconciliation, that doesn't mean to patch things up. People have the idea, some do, that Christians sort of say, well, we'll put up with all these injustices and all this kind of thing. Boy, you don't know what the New Testament's talking about when you say that Christians go back to the status quo. No, sir. Reconciliation doesn't mean that two people get together and one says, I'll give a little here if you give a little there, and then we'll patch it up and make a new go at it. That isn't reconciliation. Or for a couple of people to go arm in arm and say, we'll let bygones be bygones. That isn't reconciliation. To me, it's more like reconciling a bank statement. You don't call up the banker and say, look, you give a little, I'll give a little, and then let's let bygones be bygones. Huh? No, so what do? You correct what's wrong, and that brings harmony in the situation. And this is what reconciliation means, a basic change at the heart of things to correct what's wrong. No patching up will do. In fact, the Bible talks about those who heal the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And you aren't going to have reconciliation, or we aren't going to have peace, are we, until something happens down inside. That's why reconciliation is a radical thing. From the inside out. And there are husbands and wives that aren't getting along, and you know why? Because of pride. There's some reason, something down inside is not changed. And I've been around long enough to see that unless something inside is changed, the day will come, it'll get you. Somebody's going to pay for that. And one of the sad things is that too often it's the children that pay first and the most. But reconciliation is needed, isn't it? Calls for a radical change, a change of heart, change of mind, a change the inside out. And that's why the first words that Jesus said as he started out to do his ministry was repent and believe. And to repent means you've got to change your mind. You change your mind about God, don't you? You admit that you need him. Forgiveness, for there to be reconciliation, has to be offered and accepted. You see, forgiveness may be offered. I say to Larry, I'll forgive you for driving over my wet lawn with your car and leaving tire prints in that deep. He doesn't accept my forgiveness. Why not? He didn't drive over my lawn. Suppose he did. For him to accept my forgiveness means he'd have to admit that he did it. So it has to be on both sides. That's why Jesus said you must repent. You've got to change your mind and admit that you need forgiveness. And that does something down inside. And after we have restored our relationship with God, we've been reconciled to him, then we are in a position to do something about the reconciliation that's needed with children, a husband, or wife, or neighbor, or relatives, right? Now, when God helps us with these things, these relationships, he doesn't help us so much by amputation or by putting a thing in a brace and trying to hold it in. He heals us. And for healing, you have to take a medicine. And you know what the basic medicine is for being reconciled horizontally with people? It's a medicine that's tough to swallow. Because the medicine is that you must go to the person with whom you are in conflict. Isn't that what it says? In Matthew 5, it says that if you are praying and you remember that your brother has something against you, quit praying, leave the altar, go, be reconciled to your brother, then come back and continue your act of worship. Isn't that what it says? Matthew 5, what is it, about 23 and 24? Somewhere in there. Well, you say, but suppose it's the other way around. See, this is the case where somebody has something against me. Now, what if it's the other way around? Am I supposed to wait till they have read Matthew 5 and come and make it right? No, I'm to go to them. Matthew 18. In either case, it's my job to go and seek to be reconciled. Well, suppose when you go, you're not received. Well, you've made some progress. At least part of the hostility has been settled down. You've done your part. Now, when we seek to help others in the ministry of reconciliation, we help them to see the importance of going to others. And do people like to do that? All I'm trying to point out here is what this does. I may have shared with you one of the greatest illustrations on reconciliation and what it does that I've ever heard. I was in Denver a few years ago in a motel doing a little study, and I picked up the paper and saw that they were rerunning a TV program that this station had run a week before, an hour-long show. And they had gotten more letters from viewers favorably responding to that program than they had any program in the history of the station. And they were rerunning it. So I tuned it in. And it was simply called James Emery Bond. Not the James Bond that some might think of. This was James Emery Bond. Who it turned out to be was a Negro in his 70s who had spent his lifetime as a truck driver, now retired. And the whole hour-long program consisted of just one person on camera the whole hour, and it was this Negro gentleman, and he was being asked questions from somebody off camera. Amazing! Especially to be such a well-received program. So I watched it. And apparently what had happened was that this Negro gentleman had been watching television the night before, and there was a panel program on with the mayor, the chief of police, and other city officials talking about the race problems of Baltimore, talking about the juvenile delinquency and all the rest. And apparently as he sat there and watched it, he was so taken with their earnestness and their grappling with the problem, and the fact that, as he put it, he felt he had an answer. But he said, I don't know who would listen to me. And he said, I have no way of communicating like they did, and yet it's a good word to say for them. And so apparently went down to the television station the next day to talk to somebody. And they had the good sense to videotape the whole interview, and that constituted the program. And for instance, they asked him about his family. He told about his wife. He said, you know, I never let my wife go out in the sun or the wind. And today her skin is just as smooth as it was when she was 20. Why, he said, in fact, if she didn't have arthritis so bad, I'd court her today like I did when she was 20. And he told about his family. And one son was a doctor, another one was this, and so on. And then he began to tell what he knew about God. And as they talked on a little bit more, he told about his boyhood in Baltimore. How on the way to school, the white boys would throw rocks at him. And the various circumstances that came up, they began to build a hatred in his heart for white people. And he's telling this on TV. Then he said that he's a young man in his 20s. He started driving truck. And one day the milkman went by the house, and he thought how wonderful it would be if he could just have a little milk to drink before he went to work in the morning. He thought that would be good. So he stopped the milkman, who was a white man, and asked if he would leave milk for him. And the milkman said, "I don't deliver milk to niggers." He's telling this on TV. So he said, "I called up the milk company to find out if that was true, that they didn't deliver milk to black people." And they said, "No, that was not true." And they'd see to it that he started leaving a quart of milk every morning. So he did. And he told how he appreciated this and all. He had a wonderful way of saying things. He was obviously uneducated, but he had almost a poetic way about expressing himself. Then he said a couple of weeks went by and he realized he wasn't getting a bill. So he stopped the milkman one day and said, "I'd like to have a bill so I could pay you." And the milkman said, "I don't take money from niggers." "Well," he said, I feel like I've got to pay you. I don't feel right about that. You've got to let me pay you." And so the milkman said, "I tell you what you do. You lay the money on the fence post." So James Emery Bond said, "I thought I'd have a little fun with him. So I said, well, I won't feel like I paid you unless I put it in your hand." And the man said, "No, sir, you put it on the fence post." So he said, "I laid the money out on the fence post, and when he reached out his hand to take it, I just laid my hand right on top of his." And he said he jerked it away. So he told how this hatred began to deepen. Then he said, an evangelist came to town by the name of Billy Sunday. He said, "I went to hear him, and I heard how Jesus Christ died on the cross, and also how he changed men's hearts." And he told how something welled up inside of him, and he was drawn, and he said, "I walked the sawdust trail. And I went down there," and he said, "I received Jesus Christ into my heart." Then he went on to tell how that apparently a couple of days later, the milkman, unbeknownst to James Emery Bond, went to hear Billy Sunday. He too walked the sawdust trail and brought Jesus Christ into his heart. And a couple days later, he told how the milkman stopped out in front, got out of the milk truck, came up and knocked on the door. And he said, and with tears streaming down his cheeks, he apologized for the way he treated me. And he says, "I've loved him, and he's loved me ever since." Now that's reconciliation, isn't it? There's the ministry of reconciliation. And if there's ever an up-to-date ministry, it's that today, right? And all the racial tensions, and the nation tensions, the family tensions, the university tensions, we need reconciliation. And it's to be found in the one who came to make peace. And we have been given that ministry. I say that's the work of the Lord, don't you? That's right in the heart of the whole thing, isn't it? A ministry of reconciliation. Now, wherever there's sin, wherever there's sorrow, wherever there's tension, wherever there's suffering, that's where we belong. Where families are about to break up, that's where we belong. Where there's suffering in a life, that's where we belong. But I'll tell you honestly, I don't like to be there. Do you? No, sir. That's a struggle for me. And I condemn myself. I feel guilty about it. I had something happen to me a few years ago that slapped me across the face, and I needed it. A businessman from town called me up, said I need some spiritual advice. And he came out to see me and told me that the doctor had told him he had lung cancer. And so I talked with him a little, and then for the next months he was in and out of the hospital. And whenever he saw in the paper that I was speaking somewhere, I'd look in the audience and there he'd be. Then I remember the last time he was in Penrose Hospital and I went up to see him. And he wanted to hold my hand. Well, I've been squeamish about holding a man's hand. I don't like holding a man's hand under any circumstances. And here I was uncomfortable and didn't know what to do here. And And I, about 5 minutes, I left. I went on to some business, and some days later he died. A couple months later, I picked up a magazine, and I read a statement by one of the doctors, Mayo, one of the founders of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And in it he said, when I die, I hope it's quick. But if there is some delay, I hope there is someone near me who loves me and who will hold my hand. I could have held his hand. That's where I belong, really. That's where I belong. Whether there's alienation from God, or conflict with others, or somebody needs steadiness and harmony and courage and security down in his own soul, that is where I belong. That is the work of the Lord. Don't you think so? I do. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. But you know, there it says, be steadfast, unmovable. I call that the fine print of the contract. And I have a good reason for calling it the fine print. Because you would think that in such a wonderful, glorious ministry as reconciliation, that people would receive this with their arms wide open. But we have miscalculated as to the power of the enemy and the exceeding sinfulness of sin, if we think that's going to be the case. And you find that it's a public ministry, not a private. And the sooner you start to help somebody else, you begin to be exposed and to shot at. For instance, people who are guilty. Guilt almost always manifests itself in aggressive tendencies of self-justification and placing blame on others. Who are you to be around? Are you a self-righteous person? More righteous than I? Who are you, deacon? There are all kinds of things. I told some of you, I guess it was last year, that I went through an experience when I approached my 25th year with the Navigators. In some ways it was kind of a kick, in the other ways it was very symbolic. Just before that day, the 25th anniversary of that week, I was telling some of you, my wife and I were going through our quarterly rearranging of the stuff in the garage. It isn't getting rid of the stuff, it's rearranging the stuff. We have a one-car storage at our place. No room for the car. But we rearranged the garage again anyway, and on a Saturday. And the following Monday, somebody had looked up in one of Doss Trotman's journals, and it was an entry 25 years before. Sandy came to join us today, spent the afternoon rearranging the garage, the things in the garage. And I thought to myself, isn't that a kick? What progress? 25 years ago, straightening a garage. 25 years later, straightening a garage. Real progress, Sandy. Then I began to think, but you know, that's not unlike the Christian life. 25 years before, it was kind of tough for me to get up in the morning and have a quiet time. 25 years later, I'm still struggling with it. 25 years ago, scripture memory, I had to have some help and, you know, screw up the old determination to get it. 25 years later, I find it a little bit tougher, really. So, well, that's true. And besides, the things that made for spiritual health then, same things 25 years later. But then I thought of something that's quite a bit different. 25 years before, or about 26 before that, Lucy and I remember, walked forward in a meeting one night, and we, as they sang, "Follow me, Follow thee, I will follow thee, my Lord. And together we dedicated our lives to the Lord for wherever he would lead and whatever he wanted. And we meant that. Well, 25 years later, I was going through it again. And I was struggling with some things. And one day, some of you know Pat Nelson, who was my secretary at that time. I was telling her some of these inner struggles. And she got up to leave the office. She turned back and looked at me. She's a very quiet spoken girl. But she let me have a quiet A-bomb. It had, if there is such a thing, it was an underground explosion that got inside. She said, Lorne, have you considered that maybe you're not dedicated? And what she meant was to the task I had. And I was kind of squirming under the collar of the presidency, the navigators, and this, that, and the other. But when she said the word yielded, maybe you're not yielded. And I just knew that quickly, that was it. She's right. I had a new yielding to do. But you know what I found? It was a lot harder than it was 25 years before to walk up that aisle. Because now I know a little more what's involved. And I know that there are fantastic joys and experiences that I never expected, but I also know it hurts. And it hurts in a number of ways. And when Paul said to be steadfast, unmovable, he said it because people need to be told to be steadfast and unmovable, because we'll tend to be unsteadfast. And we tend to be movable. Because there are pressures and criticisms and underminings, and there's this struggle, there's the enemy, there's our own selves, the whole business. And I'll admit to you tonight that I decided 2 years ago that I wasn't going to come trotting up to the Lord and say, Lord, okay, I yield all over again. I decided I was going to take this time, think it through very carefully. Weighing the costs, the new costs, and make a new yielding to him. And I did that. I don't know. Maybe some of you need to do that this week. Maybe that's why the Lord brought you all the way back in California to Colorado. Because maybe there may be a new plane of your life. A new era in your life that he wants to lead you into. But before that happens, you need to have a new yielding to him. Brand new. Getting the picture into sharper focus and seeing it and looking it straight in the eye, so to speak, and saying, yes, Lord, I will. I will. Steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Abounding, doing more than enough. I think sometimes it says doing more than enough because most seem to be doing less than enough. And you know what that means? That means such routine, mundane, everyday things that just rearranging your schedule. Cancel a few magazine subscriptions. Put a moratorium on TV. That's what it involved, doesn't it? Because you can't both be watching the boob tube and out calling on people who need reconciliation at the same time. And besides, we've got a pretty tough job and we work pretty hard and we're entitled to a little relaxation. And all the other dozen and one justifications that we have for not getting involved and being out in the work of the ministry. When did I start preaching? I don't know. I was going to keep this short. You know that? Since I saw you last, I learned from somebody that for a speech to be immortal, it does not have to be everlasting. Now, this isn't going to be immortal, and I don't want it to be everlasting either. But you know, there's something you have to work at. Just a schedule. And it's a good thing I brought in that side light, because I forgot the illustration I was going to use that would have prolonged the message. But let me wind up to say this. See how fortunate we are? Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Isn't that great? It lasts for now and for eternity. When Jesus came and he started his ministry, he stood up in the synagogue to read. Here's what he said. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed. Poor, captives, blind, oppressed. That's who he came for. And when the Apostle Paul received his commission, his work of the Lord, in Acts 26:18, here's what his job was to be. He said, you're to open their eyes that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those which are sanctified by faith that is in me. And that's what we're sent to do. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Or whatever your need is down deep inside, whatever your new yieldedness may be, I trust that'll be done here this week. That's why we're here, and I'm sure that's why you're here. And when I say you're here and you need it, I'm talking about me too. I really am. I mean that. That's not a speech. That's not a conference message. That's a testimony. Let's pray, shall we?